Hello and welcome to Bend the Knee, a Song of Ice and Fire podcast. I am Sir Matt, the Bud Knight.
And I am Sir Jimmy of House Nuts. Welcome to our Song of Ice and Fire book club. Today we are into Storm of Swords Davos Chapter 1.
Yeah, and we are still the broken.
Yes.
The broken. Yeah, so interesting times, to say the least. I probably, for those who will be watching the video, I don't know that I'm going to do video again. I'm probably not doing video. I mean, there'll be like a video podcast uploaded to YouTube, but I have like this crazy setup right now because much like Mike Tyson, my back is broken.
It's spinal.
Spinal.
Okay?
Like it is broken. So I guess I have a slipped disc. It's pinching my nerve. I don't know, man. All I know is I literally cannot sit down. So I've been standing and lying down for the past like 2 weeks. Crazy.
Yeah, I can't imagine. And you're getting a new car. I mean, this.
Yeah. Tried to drive. May have totaled my car. It's a bit bad. So, none the least, Jimmy. And then you just said you just tore your knee out.
Yeah, I have a partial tear in my patellar femoral ligament. I think that's how you say that. And it is in my right knee, which is unfortunate because my left knee's already trashed. So I'm dealing with the partial tear there, but I'm going to have a scar on my face. Like this, the only thing that has ever got me through life, folks, is the fact that I'm like okay looking. And now I'm going to have to wade my way through Westeros as a hedge knight with a big old scar on my face.
Is it interesting that you found that news out as we did the Tyrion chapter in which he realized he no longer had a nose and now he also has an enormous scar on his face?
You're right. Oh my
God. Is that just what this next wave of the podcast is going to be? Is we're going to be mirroring? Because if we're going to mirror any book, A Storm of Swords is not the one I want to mirror. Okay, like, you know, can we go back to Game of Thrones? Like, can we go back to Clash of King where things are good? Like, Storm of Swords is bad all around.
Yeah, can we just go back to, I don't know, maybe Jaehaerys building the king?
Right.
King? Like, that
would be good, wouldn't it? Right. Because right now, hey, I'm much like Davos. Now I got to go get a new car because I accidentally did some damage to it trying to drive with my herniated disc and sciatic nerve. It was bad, but Davos is stranded out there too. So I guess it's just the way it's going. But you know what? We did get some ravens. So people said, so shout out to Jack. He sent us one saying, guys, he said, Sir Matt, Sir Jamie, hope you guys heal up soon. Some milk of the poppy might help with the recovery.
I definitely need some milk of the poppy. If anything, to numb my vanity from being, you know, destroyed.
Right.
I don't know when I'm going to get this thing cut on my face though. Cause like, I don't know. Like, when do you decide to have your face opened up and then like heal for 2 weeks? Like, you can't do PT for this. But basically what happened, folks, is I have this big cyst in my cheek that is starting to grow. And I'm like, what in the world's going on? It's not cancerous or anything, but came from a clogged pore.
Wow.
So apparently I should have been using like some sort of face cleaner or something my whole life. But yeah, guess a clogged
pore. Well, that's what happens when you wrestle. You know,
you're right.
It's dirty.
You're right. You're right.
You know,
a damn shame, but we'll make it through. We'll persevere. You know, mm-hmm. we'll find a way through this.
Right. I mean, what's next week? Maybe things will open up. You know, this week's gonna be about Davos getting. You know, this week is about Davos and he's getting stranded. So next time, on Bend the Knee, we'll see if our fortunes change here. Oh, we're into Sansa's arc where she gets forced into marriage with Tyrion. So maybe not.
Yeah, I don't think I want to go down Sansa's arc at all. So, especially if it's the show, that would be no good. Oof. No Ramsay for me, thanks.
Yeah. All right. Well, here we go. Let's dive into Davos. And by the way, there really hasn't been any news, just in terms of other things as well. Like House of the Dragon, just sort of, they're saying 2024. There was like a tiny little like Warner Brother insider thing saying, okay, looking like 2024. George hasn't really posted anything. So kind of in a dry spell, at least for sort of Game of Thrones news.
Yeah.
As a Warner Brothers insider, I like to call myself, the only thing I can say that I see happening, I've been talking to you in our group chat, Jimmy, you know, and Sir Matthew and Sir Ryan as well, is you know, Hogwarts Legacy is doing really well, selling a lot of games. It's blowing up. You know, the DC brand does really well with video games. It's got another game coming out. So maybe if you're there at Warner Brothers, you're thinking, you know, Harry Potter's making a lot of money with video games. DC's making a lot of money with video games. We've got Multiverses, which is doing pretty well. And that's kind of like got some stuff. Wow. Feels like, you know, what other big franchise do we have that could use a video game?
Yes. I mean, I can think of at least one.
Yeah.
DuckTales.
Give us. Yeah, that too. But give us a Game of Thrones video game.
Come on.
Because the ones we've had haven't been particularly great.
And as Matt knows, but if you are listening and you don't know, Skyrim was originally supposed to be in a Song of Ice and Fire video game.
Yeah. So maybe someday we'll get one. But I'm just saying, hey, if you're sitting there and you're like, hey, we're making money here, you know.
Not to mention that George's name was attached to the game of the year last year.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, yeah, let From Software. Jimmy and I were just talking about them beforehand.
Let's go.
That might be too dark for Westeros.
I'm in.
I don't know. Can they like dial it back to be like to fit into Westeros?
Wow.
But have George Martin and the creators of, you know, Elden Ring and Dark Souls and all that stuff and make a Game of Thrones video game.
I'm so in.
How much money would it make?
$50 million, I think. Elden Ring has sold $20 million. I would say $50 million. I think people would be really into it. You would never see me again. That you would have to find another co-host because I would never do anything else again in my life.
I should look up and see who created the well, there was the Telltale game, which is kind of cool, where you played as like House Forester. It only ended up being one season. But there was that other Game of Thrones RPG.
Oh, yeah, it was back in like 2012, I think, and it had the worst combat, but it had a really interesting storyline. It was like this person that came back over and they were a red priest from Ashai, and they had like landed right when around the Civil War was happening. And then you had a couple different chapters at the wall. So the story of the actual RPG was fantastic, but the combat was terrible. I mean, miserable to play.
But it had voice acting too, right? It didn't have acting from
Jorah Mormont was in it. Everybody was in it.
Yeah. Now I want to see I wonder who made that video game. Game of Thrones 2012 video game. Developer Cyanide. Atlas was the one who published it, which is interesting because Atlas is known for making very good RPGs because they make the Persona series and stuff like that. But that was before they sort of got absorbed by Sega, which now they are owned there. And we'll get to the chapter here. So Cyanide, the developers, they haven't really made a lot of good games, to be honest. So they do like the Blood Bowl games. That's kind of their biggest
thing. We don't need that. Let's hand it over to somebody else. That's all we're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, George has already got a relationship with From Software.
Don't tempt me, man. Don't tempt me. If you're telling me I could be a hedge knight and just go build my valor and one day become a Kingsguard. I mean, dunk the lunk. Thick as a castle wall. I mean, come on, dude. That's it.
Is it interesting that they haven't made more? I wonder why they haven't made more video games in this universe. It seems like an incredibly missed opportunity.
Well, I think part of it is that, and I've heard this before, is that originally one of the Game of Thrones games were going to be like a battle strategy, kind of like Total War.
Right.
And while I understand that, I don't think that is what people love Westeros for. You know what I'm saying? Like, I feel like it's more people are invested in the story of the characters and like going and seeing the world. So I think especially around that time, you know, now we live in a time where open world RPGs are everything. Mm-hmm. But back then, I think people were a little bit more obsessed with like the StarCraft, genre.
Right.
RTS. And I think that they were trying to go into something more like that, or even like a Civilization type game or something. But I think to do Westeros right, you have to do an open world. I think that's the only way to do it.
Yeah, because, you know, I think when you look at, like, say, Hogwarts Legacy, which I think is just, you know, that's the game that's out right now that's huge and everything. Mm-hmm. One, it's easy to pick a time because you're like, okay, we're going to set this like way before all that other stuff takes place. And then you also just sort of have a central location that everyone knows, whereas Westeros is like huge. So I guess where would you set it? Like if you only set it in like King's Landing, which by the way, a game that you could make an Assassin's Creed type game that takes place in King's Landing. Like you're there on missions and you just get to run around King's Landing.
I mean, like, it could flea bottom.
Yeah, that'd be sick.
Yeah, it'd be dope. But I want all of Westeros. I want the whole thing.
you want the whole thing. You want an Elder Scrolls like.
Yes. It's the only way you can do it justice. Like you got to do it all. Maybe leave out Essos. Maybe that's the DLC after like a year or something. But I need the whole shebang. If they could do Fallout 76 and have the whole state of West Virginia, they got to be able to do Westeros. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah, right now I do believe they just added in Multiverses, which is sort of Warner Brothers version of like Smash Brothers, but it features like, you know, DC characters, and they haven't included Harry Potter yet, or Lord of the Rings, but I think those are coming. But they've got like Scooby-Doo and some of these other things, but they do have Arya Stark, and they did just add, I believe, the throne room. So they are sort of adding some Game of Thrones type stuff to their thing. I guess I wonder if there's pushback from George.
Doubt it. He's like, cash the checks, get him.
Yeah, saved. It just seems weird. It just seems weird that there's not, like, you know, they made those Shadow of Mordor games.
Yeah.
For Lord of the Rings, so those were pretty sweet. I mean, again, that's in that sort of Assassin's Creed style, like gameplay style.
Mm-hmm.
You could totally do that in Game of Thrones. Just seems like it's millions of dollars just waiting for you guys to go do it.
Yeah, and plenty of us would play it for sure.
Oh god, man. Yeah, I go absolutely nuts. So all right, well, with that, let's move over to the Davos chapter. So the last time we were with Davos was the Battle of Blackwater.
Frightening.
Much kind of like we were with Tyrion, and you know, very similar to Tyrion. He sort of gets knocked out and we have to wait and see what happens until the next book, which is where we're at now. So Davos has washed up on the shore of a small island in Blackwater Bay. He remembers swimming beneath the chain boom and then getting caught by the current and gulping seawater. But somehow he is alive and he believes the Seven have still have some use for him. Despairing over the loss of four of his sons in the sea battle, he contemplates dying on the island, but decides instead to live. A Lycini ship rescues him of Salador Sand's fleet. So this chapter is incredibly short, so we'll dive into it as much as we can. But I would say sort of the first big takeaway from this is that this is honestly one of the only chapters that I could find, and I've been looking on like forums and stuff like that to see what other people say about it, and I found this one. This is from the Song of Ice and Fire reread subreddit, and this comment was left, and I honestly kind of thought this myself too. It says, this chapter is interesting as it's the only time we actually see the Seven actually do something. Compared to R'hllor, for example, it's nice that the Seven get some validity points here for once. You know, Mother, have mercy. Davos prayed, save me, gentle Mother. Save us all. My luck is gone and my sons. You know, he was weeping freely now, salt tears streaming down his cheeks. The fire took it all. The fire, which is really interesting. And I think that's a big parallel because this is where you also start to get like a huge split between Davos and Stannis, and Davos is going to kind of start to go in his direction.
Right.
And here Davos is cursing the fire, which Stannis is going more towards. And we still don't know the way it's going to play out in Winds of Winter. Assume it's probably going to be somewhat similar to the way it plays out in the show.
Yeah.
Where, you know, Stannis actually gets too close to the fire and, you know, kills his daughter and then ends up losing anyway. So it is kind of interesting here that Davos is turning to the Seven and cursing the fire.
Yeah, so there's a lot going on in this chapter. It is a short chapter. It's very much like, where's Davos now? Where are we going to propel him? What's his new motivation, which we know is to kill Melisandre? But there's a lot to go on in this chapter. And the first thing is the survivor's guilt that he feels. He feels like, what is a father who outlives their sons? Like, why wouldn't he be able to protect them? Now they're dead. And he has a really tough time with that by also being stuck on an island, being dehydrated, fighting, getting crabs, trying to kill, like, you know, birds and eat them. I mean,
yeah, if you've ever seen the movie Castaway,
I would say it's Castaway.
It's totally Castaway. Yeah, it's
Castaway 100%.
And which is, I'm wondering if I, you know, George wrote this, you know, sort of. I mean, Castaway was like what, like mid '90s, late '90s, or early 2000s, one of those things. So certainly in that time, frame, yeah.
And George loves film and TV, and has written for it. I'm sure that he took a little bit of inspiration from Castaway for this chapter. And. And it's a sad chapter because Davos did outlive his sons, and he's trying to deal with the survivor's guilt of this and thinking back on the battle and exactly how everything went down. And the one thing that he immediately notes is, and he curses, is wildfire and pyromancer's piss, as he calls it, which is my new favorite term for wildfire. I will only be referring to it as pyromancer's piss from now on. So thank you, Davos, for that. But yeah, there's a religious experience on this island, and it's kind of up to the reader to decide what of that is perspective and what of that is reality. And it's a good question. And also the fact that the seven were toppled down. So like, would they answer from Davos? And is he only feeling like the seven helped him out because he does feel like he is going to be standing up against this priestess of R'hllor and of the fire? So there's a lot to go on here. Did you notice that he never once blames Stannis?
Yeah.
He mentions always, what Stannis has done, but it's always Melisandre. And it is clear as day for me. This is my opinion. That Davos's arc has to result in him having to face the fact that Stannis has been he's the one making these terrible decisions the whole time. I'm not saying Melisandre is innocent, but I'm saying that he will eventually see Stannis burn Shireen, you know, and then that will be where he finally has to put the blame solely on Stannis. He is doing everything other than blaming Stannis, and now he is setting off to kill Melisandre.
Yeah, I mean, this line right here, he's like, you called the fire, you know, you burned us, right? And he is blaming her. It is, yeah, interesting to think about, because, you know, if you go to the show, like, obviously he does have the run-in with Melisandre, where he comes back and sort of, but when he realizes what happens, it's sort of explained to him. He's not there for it. He could be there for it, for Stannis burning Shireen.
Yeah, it's all going to depend on when he comes back with Rickon, right?
Right.
But do you feel like it's trending that way, to where Davos keeps blinding himself to Stannis's poor, poor, poor decisions and eventually has to face it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's going to have to come a little more to the forefront.
Yeah.
And to see that it's really Stannis's problem more so than Melisandre's.
Yeah.
Because the other thing that's kind of weird about the timing is, you know, like, if Melisandre is the one to resurrect Jon Snow, is that, how does that Davos Melisandre conflict resolve itself?
Yeah, I don't see Davos actually killing Melisandre in the books. I don't think it will happen. I think, like most of our characters who set out on a quest or a mission, it's going to get messed up. Almost no one is going to end up doing what they've set out to do, and he's clearly setting out to kill Melisandre. I think also there's some really good symbolism in him losing his fingers. So I lost my sons and I lost my luck. And in a way, I think him losing his fingers is the beginning of him maybe losing his allegiance to the man who gave him his fingers, which is Stannis. So,
yeah, I will say this chapter is one, this in combination with the last chapter that Davos is in, which is his, I think it's probably like Davos 4, because he doesn't have that many chapters in A Clash of Kings. I think it is Davos 4, but I could be wrong. Maybe it's like 7 or something. Regardless, though, you know, the idea that Azor Ahai may not end up being like, you know, like, maybe it is like something like it is in the show, where in theory it's John that's Azor Ahai, right?
Yeah.
And it's like more like he's the one who brings people together to take on the Night King, White Walkers, whatever, as opposed to actually like John's got like a flaming sword going one-on-one. But one of the whole, you know, some of the language around it is a lot of people look to this chapter for the possibility of Davos. You know, if you sort of look at it, because there's a lot of salt water mentioned in this chapter over and over again, and he's sort of reborn right? Like on this island, now in the faith of the seven, if you want, or whatever, you know. But, you know, you look at it, when the red star bleeds and the darkness gathers, Azor Ahai shall become shall be born again amidst salt, smoke and salt. You know, when he opens his mouth to scream, the water came rushing in, tasting of salt, and Davos knew that he was drowning.
Okay, so, but
I mean,
listen, we're talking about R'hllor, we're talking about the seven. Let's show some piety and some respect for the drown god. Like, are we considering that maybe the drown god is the one that burped Davos up?
Could be.
Depends on if you believe in divine intervention, I suppose.
Yeah, so it's definitely, yeah, it's interesting that this is one, you know, that does. Like we said, this chapter's kind of short. Mm-hmm. I think one other thing I want to pull out from out here. There's actually a few points I want to pull out here, but I think sort of just a bigger takeaway, and then I can pull up some specifics, is Davos loses sons.
Yeah.
Here. Yeah, that's like the show does hint. The show, I think he does have a son.
I think he has at least one.
I think he does have one son who does die in the Battle of Blackwater, but it's never really brought up again or anything. But here he loses almost everything.
Yeah, he has a few sons left. He obviously has his wife. But yeah, he loses, I believe, four sons here in this chapter. And it obviously is affecting him greatly. I like that George also takes time to kind of go over that. You know, he didn't glance over at Davos. This chapter almost feels like a fever dream at some points. And I think he's trying to process that while also trying to stay alive. And he's asking himself constantly, why should he live when Allard, Merrick, Mathos, and perhaps Devon as well, and Dale, good old Dale. Dale does not seem like a Westeros name, by the way.
I know.
George, come on. but yeah, they all passed away. And he's trying to deal with all of this. Survivor's guilt, loss of his children. I mean, this is rough. Rough stuff for our boy Davos. And I guess the only thing that could get him off that island was the fact that, one, he remained loyal to Stannis, by the way. He said, I serve King Stannis, which I think is telltale of his stubbornness, which may be a good or bad thing, but also the fact that he wants to kill Melisandre. Vengeance it is for our man.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff in here also about there's a lot of stuff in here about gods, like not just but just a lot of lines and some other sort of lines that I think are kind of cool to pull up, right? So it's talking about the little cave he's in, saying, you know, his cave was all the shelter he had, and that was a little enough. Driftwood and bits of charred debris would wash up and on the strand during low tide, but he had no way to strike or a spark or start a fire. Once in desperation, he had tried rubbing two pieces of driftwood against each other, but the wood was rotted and his efforts earned him only blisters. His clothes were sodden as well, as he had lost one of his boots somewhere in the bay before he washed up here. Thirst, hunger, exposure, they were his companions, which I think is, you know, sort of like describes the entire chapter. Which again is really small. But so then, you know, he's talking about it's too far to swim. He's weak, but it didn't matter. Davos had always been a sailor. He was meant to die at sea. The gods beneath the waters have been waiting for me, he told himself. It's past time I went to them. And then ends up, you know, seeing some other things. You know, he talks of a Merlin king, right? You know, that could be down there. So he does kind of talk about some of these sea gods, which is certainly interesting. And then also, it's kind of, it's not like something that I think is like maybe George was hinting at just the way he wrote this chapter, but it's like, oh, that is kind of a cool parallel. Is just if you go back, it's like he's trying to strike a fire, but he can't do it. And you sort of think of like Stannis and fire. Mm-hmm. And now he's looking towards the seven, and it's like the seven that ultimately, because he prays to the mother, if you look at it that way, or perhaps like the sea gods, right? It's something, I guess, obviously, almost anything other than fire.
Yeah, fire is not there to help him in his time of need. And there's a ton of symbolism here. And I do think that this is written to be a religious experience for Davos. And I also think we're supposed to kind of question it a little bit based on what he pulls out of this. Like, I don't know if the seven would necessarily want him to go kill someone. But hey, gods work in mysterious ways, they say. So,
Yeah, let me. I'll pull up the part here towards the end. Right, it was her work. Dabo said again, mm-hmm. more weakly, her work and yours, Anya Knight. You rode her into Storm's End and the Black of Night, so she might lose her shadow child. You are not guiltless. No, you rode beneath her banner and flew it from your mast. You watched the Seven burn at Dragonstone and did nothing. She gave the Father justice to the fire and the Mother's mercy and the wisdom of the crone, smith, and stranger, maid, and warrior. She burnt them all to the glory of her cruel god, and you stood and held your tongue. Even when she killed old Maester Cressen, even then you did nothing. And then the sail was 100 yards away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you actually think about Davos too, Davos has maybe seen some of the most messed up things to happen in Westeros in like over 100 years, considering the fact that he, one, got hit by the Pyromancer's piss, which is wildfire.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
And he also watched a demon shadow baby be born out of Melisandre. Like, he has actually seen proof of heinous things. So it's actually not that surprising that he would then say, well, why not pray to the Seven? Why not have some belief in something else? Because if that other thing is real, I don't want to be a part of that, because it obviously is devious. So Davos is the person probably has the most reason to believe in any of the religions.
He probably does. And if you continue on here, this is where, as you were saying earlier, so like the galley might be Joffrey's. He realized suddenly when Salazar's Anne's approaching him, and he's like, oh, he doesn't know what king he should say, right? Mm-hmm. But he knows that the ship is Lysine. She was Salador Sands. The mother sent her here, the mother in her mercy. She had a task for him. Stannis lives. He knew that then. I have a king still and sons. I have other sons and a wife, a loyal and loving. How could he have forgotten? The mother was merciful indeed. Stannis, he shouted back at the Lyseni. Gods be good. I serve King Stannis. Yeah, it's almost like he's kind of delusional, man.
I mean, he's willing to blame himself. He said, you're not guiltless, Anya Knight. Like, he will blame everyone but Stannis in this chapter. It's crazy.
I know, it's kind of heartbreaking to see.
It's really hard. he is very blind, and I think that you know, he feels like he owes a debt. You know, he was a Onion Knight. He was basically a pirate, right? That got raised up into knight status and everyone looked down on him. He also, by the way, he says, maybe this rock will be my tombstone and they'll call it the Onion Rock, which I thought was kind of funny. I want an onion rock for my desk.
all right. Well, you know, that might be it. Like I said, we said it's one of these chapters where sometimes they're just like a page.
Yeah, but some good stuff there. You know, it doesn't have everything. It doesn't have all the theories, but certainly a lot of Westeros or Plantos lore in there with all the different gods, and then Davos being a castaway fanfic is pretty interesting. So let us know either down in the comments on YouTube or send us an email at btkcast@gmail.com and let us know what you think of Davos in the beginning of his arc for Storm of Swords. And do you think Davos had a real religious experience, or is he delusional?
Yeah, I think he's delusional.
I think he's delusional. Yeah.
Yeah, especially, you know, a cool thing to do actually might be, we should just pay attention to some as we progress further and we get to some more of these other Davos chapters like this. I think this is probably one of those chapters that when you're reading it, like we're reading it, where it's kind of like in succession, you're like, okay, this one isn't important. But when you look at it in sort of the whole Davos arc, might be really important, especially the idea of Azor Ahai and some of the deal with the gods, because here he is praying to the Seven, saying, you know, I've forsaken the Seven, but then the Seven are the ones to come and get him. But then he's also praying to the Get Down God, and then he's cursing R'hllor, but who knows, maybe R'hllor is the one that ultimately saves him, because King Stannis, like, you know, loyal person is ultimately the one that comes to his aid.
Yeah, and also the fact that Davos seems to always be at the right place at the right time to see these crazy things happening, and then he has this kind of own personal miracle. But if he is going to get Rickon on Skagos, he might be one of the first people in many, many millennia to see unicorns.
It's true.
I always got to bring up the unicorns on Skagos.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Every time.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, let's move on to Send a Raven. And this comes to us from Lord Robert of House Blackbird. He's been sending us a couple here recently. So he says, "Dear sirs, this time we'll get a topic for Sir Matt. I'd like to talk about the Tower of Joy." Says, sure, maybe he references like an Order of the Green Hand video as well. I don't know. Maybe I haven't watched them a lot recently, but they do have some of the stuff I've seen back in the day was really good. Says, "We're told by George that we can't take Ned's fever dream literally. So what happens there? Tower of Joy is at the borders of Dorne, not too far away from the road, presumably. Strange thing is that three Kingsguard are waiting for Ned outside the tower, so anyone can see them. Shining so anyone can see them. Sounds pretty much like that's not really what happened. Plus, the numbers Ned gives us don't really make sense. There should be a maester, nuns, guards, servants, etc. There's little chance that there was actually a fight like we saw in the dream on the show, of course. What if there was more of a discussion and argument than a literal fight? What if Rhaegar told the Kingsguard Aegon's prophecy and that they agreed that Jon or, you know, whoever the child is the prince that was promised, and it's, you know, and is necessary to prepare for the long night. I suppose Ned's companions got killed because they didn't agree to let the Kingsguard go, that Lyanna was kidnapped and they shouldn't keep this all a secret. I like an idea that when we're talking about Ned getting back, taking the Sword of the Morning, like to Starfall, is actually not referring to the sword, but Arthur Dayne as well. And when being there, they agreed that Ashara Dayne will take care of whoever the child is, be it Jon or would take care of Fagon," he's saying here. "My claim is that all three of the Kingsguard are alive. Proof is in the fever dream. Ned remembers their faces, but not the ones that accompanied him." He's like, I know where he's going. "I look at the Order of the Green Hand video that references like Oswald Wendt could be Corrin Halfhand, Gerald Hightower is Tormund Giantsbane, and Arthur Dayne is Mance Rayder. Corrin even quotes Oswald saying that their knees don't bend so easily," referring to Mance. "Tormund has one thing that could lead to Gerald, and it's a little mention he knows maesters need ink and paper to send a raven. There's a theory I like about Lyanna and Rhaegar were actually hiding in Winterfell when Ned found out that he expelled Benjen to the Night's Watch. Even though it's a nice theory, there's a lot of speculations and not a clear timeline. So ultimately, what do you think happened at the Tower of Joy? Did Howlin and Ned, you know, plus a baby, take down the tower by themselves? Are there Kingsguard alive? Did Ned, you know, bring the baby all the way to Starfall, or was it done differently? You know, this topic is hard, you know, especially in trying to write it in a coherent structure. Thanks a lot for answering. Praise the Garth, Lord Robert of House Blackbird." So he's hinting at like a couple different theories here. One of which we've talked about a lot, and I'm somewhat of, you know, definitely of a possible believer in. And that the idea that, like, let's say some of the Kingsguard members, or even perhaps Rhaegar or whatever, could be some people beyond the wall, right? Like, you have, you know, like Corrin Halfhand, you have Gerald Corrin Halfhand might be like Oswald Wendt, Gerald Hightower is Tormund Giantsbane, and then Arthur Dayne is Mance Rayder. I think I'm a little more in the idea that Mance might be Rhaegar, because I think there's more parallels to him, but I do think there's still a possibility that that is, you know, the case as well. I definitely think, regardless, if you just want to look at, say, Tormund, there's something weird about the way Tormund is presented in the books, which is really different than the way he's presented in the show. And this theory he's sort of referencing, it's an old Order of the Green Hand video, and I don't know if other people have covered it as well. I just know I specifically have seen their video on it. Talking about, if you really pay close attention to the way that Tormund talks in the books, it's almost like he's trying to talk like a wildling, as opposed to just talking the way a wildling normally would talk. right? It's almost like he feels like he's playing a part, because sometimes he will say something. Sometimes he does say things that it's like, how do you know about that? And then he'll like immediately revert to like a joke, you know, and he says like "r" and stuff like that, like a pirate. And so it's just, it is a little weird. It is definitely a little weird.
Well, I will say this. I've never really taken much note of Tormund in the book compared to what we did in the TV show, because obviously he had a really big part to play there as a fan favorite. So that's something I'm going to have to be keeping my eyes on as we continue our reread. But I'm very much of a believer that Mance Rayder is Mance Rayder. I used to love the Rhaegar theory. And then I also have seen people talk about maybe him being Arthur Dayne. But for me, I think one of the things that you have to consider is, if these Kingsguard are these wildlings, how did that happen? And why would the wildlings take these people in? They clearly hate kneelers. These people are the ultimate kneel. I mean, they're Kingsguard. So do they just forge beyond the wall and just kind of mesh into the camps? I mean, maybe, but it doesn't seem likely. It seems like wildlings are pretty brutal towards people they're not familiar with. I mean, even the tribes of the wildlings fight each other. So I've never been big on people going beyond the wall and becoming someone else. I've never right. seen it happening. I do think Tower of Joy is a little weird, because I don't see how Kingsguard, especially led by Arthur Dayne, lost to Ned and Hallen Reed. Though Hallen Reed himself is one of the biggest question marks in the entire series. The Kragnir.
I'll tell you right now, Hallen, like, it's all the stuff surrounding Hallen is incredibly weird, because when Mira Reed tells this story, she never says "my dad." She never says Howland. She describes him as like the chronic man.
Yeah.
And then also, it's also like, you, from one point of view, you're supposed to believe that he goes to the tourney and he gets picked on, but he literally goes to the Isle of Faces, which is described as this like place that nobody comes back from. And he goes and just trains there. And he has like chronic man magic.
He's like a monk almost. Yeah, it's so weird. Yeah. I love Hallen Reed. I think he's one of the coolest variables for the final books. And the fact that he's still alive is like, what? Like, that's so crazy. And obviously the show never capitalized on that. So in the books, Hallen Reed matters. Hallen Reed matters a ton. So the fact that Hallen Reed's even there, automatically my interest is piqued, and I'm not trusting anything I'm being told. But the whole Arthur Dayne losing to Ned doesn't seem right. Just doesn't seem right.
Maybe Ned's a little more skilled than I think.
He might be. He might be, especially 20 years ago in the heat of battle. He might have been sharp. So it's tough to say. But, you know, him then going to bringing, the Sword of the Morning back into Dorne to go into Starfall, and then Ashara Dayne killing herself, like the whole thing.
Right.
There's no way that it's a random thing. Like, George is like, oh, I'll just have this person kill themselves, but we never find the body. Like, obviously there's more to it.
Right. Yeah, I'm with you. It's one of those things where it's like, when you start looking at conspiracy theories, like of anything, right? Mm-hmm. As soon as one thing in the conspiracy theory doesn't make sense, then it raises questions for like the whole thing, right? That's right. Yeah. It's why, you know, like, you look at some of the conspiracy theories in our world, right? I mean, you know, like 9/11, okay? Some of it doesn't add up. I'm not saying all of it doesn't. But if one piece of it doesn't add up, then it throws the whole thing into question. Okay. Right. How did JFK die? I don't know, but it's kind of fishy. So, you know, just saying.
Oh, my.
I think I apply the same logic here that I apply there. As soon as one thing and it doesn't add up, then you have to raise it. I mean, like the whole Ashara Dayne, like that plot line makes zero sense. As we're told, because you can simply look at the idea of, hold on a second, Ashara Dayne kills herself because the story we're told is like, she possibly loves Ned. She might end up loving Brandon. That's Ned's older brother. That's part of it. Or maybe she's so overtaken with grief that Ned kills her brother that she decides to kill herself. Mm-hmm. But then they decide to honor Ned Stark with Edric Dayne. Like, regardless of what is true and what isn't true of like the story we're presented with the Chardain, that in itself makes zero sense. Why would you like that'd be like Sansa naming like whatever potential future children she has, like Jamie. You know what I mean? Like yeah. After Jamie, it doesn't add up, man. It makes no sense. Like,
yeah, it also makes you wonder. Like, obviously, we're told that John is Ned's bastard, but like, what if Ned has a bastard, but it's not John, right? Like,
right.
That could also be a thing. I don't know. I don't know how this whole thing shakes out. I don't know if Val is her. I don't know if Septa. I always forget her name. Septa Lamar. Thank you, Lamar. Is she a Chardain? I don't know. I'm not sure, man. And yeah. Why is Septa Lamar noted that she had a kid? That's what drives me insane.
Right.
Ugh.
See, that's the thing, is there's too many variables. The other one for me is like, see, I'm still a little more in the idea that Mance might be Rhaegar, just because it's like it sort of works out that Jon would sort of get this father figure or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But man, that's just, I mean, there's a lot of variables that have to happen. Robert has to kill somebody, potentially Glamour, although the proof is there for it, because it's like the Ruby Ford and rubies and clamoring like that. Okay, so like I get it, that adds up. The problem is Mance Rayder has a backstory, and people kind of like know his backstory. And then it is true, the idea of these people all going like north, and you decide to go beyond the wall and become a wildling. I guess that's not like the easiest place to go. I feel like in some ways it almost be easier to go like Essos or something in order.
Yes. We see people go to Essos constantly. We you know, people flee to Essos.
We saw it in House of the Dragon.
And not just the idea they go beyond the wall, but they get accepted by the wildlings and then end up in positions of power among the wildlings.
Right.
I mean, it just doesn't seem very likely to me. I also feel like Rhaegar being alive would hurt the story in some ways, because like Robert crushing Prince Charming is like part of the beauty of A Song of Ice and Fire. Like Prince Rhaegar is Prince Charming in a lot of ways. And George is setting out to subvert fantasy largely, but also fairy tales and other things like that. So I would almost hope that he isn't alive. Like I think that might actually be worse for me in some ways. Plus like Mance Rayder's backstory and everything is really interesting. Like Mance by himself is a very good character, even though he does have the silliest last name of all time, like Rayder. Like come on.
Yeah, the thing that becomes weird with that group is like their skill level. Like specifically it's like, okay, Mance Rayder, again, he could be, because the story we know about Mance Rayder himself is, one, he grew up, he's a wildling, he's like half wildling, half, you know, Night's Watch, whatever. He's taken to the wall, he's raised by the Night's Watch, so at least he's there like training from birth.
Mm-hmm.
Then he, you know, ends up leaving and going become a wildling, and he unites the clans, which I'm sure there has to be some bloodshed in order to do that.
Yeah.
He scales the wall, which also is like pretty freaking difficult multiple times.
Sneaks into Winterfell.
Yeah, sneaks into Winterfell. So, I mean, he's a very like ultra skilled dude. Because I think sometimes we look at wildlings and we just think like they wouldn't be at the same skill level as it's kind of funny how we do this. I think we sort of like take Khal Drogo.
Mm-hmm.
Khal Drogo, by Westeros standards, would be a wildling.
Yeah.
You know what
I mean?
Yeah. He would be. I think we sort of look at the wildlings as almost like lesser than we would say like the Dothraki, because it's like they're beyond the wall. Like they're like, you know, not criminals, but you know, like they're lesser.
They're savage.
Yeah, they're lesser people, but they're no different than Dothraki.
And tougher. They're tougher because they're surviving in the winter. I mean, they're surviving these terrible lands. Like, they don't have all the infrastructure that Westeros has. Like, if anything, they're probably better fighters because they survive all the time.
Well, I don't know. The Dothraki Sea is like the desert. I mean,
when I say them, I didn't really mean Dothraki. I meant Westeros.
I know. Westeros people. Yeah. Because just because you have a master at arms doesn't necessarily mean that they're that great.
Yeah, I mean, look at Samuel Tarly. He was born into nobility, and he's a rotten fighter and out of shape. Right. Nothing against Sam.
And even Corin Halfhand sometimes is he as good as we think he is? Whoa. Because again, well, here's the thing is you have to look at the point of view that we're told. By all accounts, John is probably as elite, if not more, than Corin Halfhand. But remember, the people, you're getting this from the Night's Watch perspective. Well, the Night's Watch is mostly made up of people not like Jon Snow, but people like Samwell Tarly. And well, even Sam's not, you know, really, but it's like, you know, Gren and all these other guys who are just like normal people who get, you know, who commit a crime and end up going. So they're not skilled. They don't fight. They don't train or anything. So when somebody who's like somewhat competent, like a Corin Halfhand shows up, they're like, wow, dude, he's really good.
Yeah, I feel like Corin was probably like, I feel like, I mean, it's obviously really bad at the point we are in the story where like we're actually reading, but maybe Corin was still part of that generation that like was pretty talented. Maybe.
Right. Right.
That's a good question though. Like
if John doesn't go through, like if John was more on like a Benjen arc where it was more so like, you know, nothing like crazy is going on, but he just goes as a person who's been trained and just becomes a ranger and just lives sort of like a normal Night's Watch life. John would probably be viewed at like Corin Halfhand, like, wow, he's like really good.
Yeah.
Cause he's like, he is really good as a sword fighter. But I mean, John might be like of the utmost elite in the books and certainly in the show. But I guess what I'm getting at is like somebody who's halfway competent by sort of like the rest of Westeros standards, where you're dealing with knights and everything, to the Night's Watch would be like a god.
Yeah, I mean, that's why John's able to come in and pretty much rout people immediately.
Yeah, so, you know, like even Corin, we're sort of told like, wow, Corin's like really good. Well, he might not actually be as good as I think we initially think because of the way George presents, you know, the information.
I think there's also a lot of people who just assume Corin Halfhand is Arthur Dayne.
Right, which is like, where I'm at. Like, yeah, like,
because we do know Arthur Dayne was, I mean, top three, probably.
Yeah. So, I mean, like Mance Rayder specifically, we know is a boss because Mance has John on his toes when he's, you know, glamored as a Rattleshirt. I mean, he has John on his toes. So we know, for example, like without question, that Mance Rayder is a boss, like without question. But, you know, is Mance, you know, like Arthur Dayne level, where he's like perhaps top two ever?
Is he Arthur Dayne?
Right. Or is Mance more like, say, Khal Drogo level, where he's like really freaking good, but he's not like the utmost of the utmost of the utmost elite?
Right. Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, we're gonna have to leave it up to the viewers when we do a tournament.
Right.
Let them tell us.
Yeah. So I guess any other you know, some other thoughts about Tower of Joy here, because he has sort of a lot of questions.
Oh yeah, you know, I mean, without a doubt.
Why aren't there maesters there? Why aren't there more people there?
Yeah, and Ned's dream is most likely not 100% accurate. I think that's fair. I think we're going to see the Tower of Joy scene through a Bran POV, which is going to give us like the actual details, like the full blown details. So that will be that'll be cool.
Right,
we just gotta wait for it,
because in the show all we had was the Kingsguard members there, and then it was actually Ashar Dayne's not even there, which she might be at the Tower of Joy as like there with Lyanna. There was a person there who I think they even actually I don't know if she's credited as her, but I think if you have the captions on, like the handmaiden that's there is actually Wyla, which is like
the wet nurse,
right? Although in the show, Robert describes her as like, you know, some like, you know, big bustling hussy, you know, at a tavern. But she's like, you know, pretty petite when you're actually in the Tower of Joy scene there. So, but yeah, I mean, there could be more people, but you know, in the show, you have to hire actors and all this stuff to have like sort of to certainly have more people there, and it's a quick scene. So you don't necessarily need to do all of that. But I do think, yeah, it will be more fleshed out when we get it. When do you think we get that? Do you think we get that in wins, or do you think
if wins we get it? Yeah.
So you think Bran will have a similar scene?
Yeah, I think so. I think that tracks. Not sure exactly the details around it, but I wouldn't be surprised if we get like that Tower of Joy, and then the next chapter is Jon being resurrected back to his body, and then that ends Winds of Winter. Like that wouldn't be shocking to be like a last chapter. Might even be an epilogue.
Could be.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Give me the book, George.
Okay, real quick. I just want to make sure he asked a couple points here. I just asked some of the idea that Lyanna and Rhaegar might have actually been hiding at Winterfell. See that?
I'm not on that train myself.
Yeah, because Lyanna would be at the Tower. I have heard that theory, but I don't.
I need to look more into it, because I do think there's something to be said about the crypts, and I've heard people saying that maybe they're hidden in the crypts and yada yada yada. So maybe we can look into that a little bit more and talk about it, and maybe even just go over the Winterfell crypts, because they're very mysterious in their own right.
Remember when they teased like tons of trailers of season 8 and they act like it was going to be the biggest deal in the world? And
I remember it
was literally nothing.
So bad. That was one of the worst parts. Yeah, that bothered me a lot. But I do think
they specifically had like trailers for it.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh man, they're going to find something. No.
Nope. Sure didn't.
Disappointing.
Disappointing.
Okay. But hey, nonetheless, thank you, Robert, for that theory. Always fun great talking. Raven. Yeah, always fun talking the Tower of Joy, because there's, you know, so many questions. Mm-hmm. So many questions around that. So, all right, guys. Well, hey, with that, as always, want to say thank you guys for playing the Game of Thrones. In our next episode, we will be discussing A Storm of Swords, Sansa 1.
And if you like our podcast, don't forget to subscribe, like us, write a review, or leave a comment, or send us a raven at btkcast@gmail.com or bendtheneepodcast.com.
We will see you next time. And remember that winter is coming.